On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are 1,000 miles of pipeline crisscrossing Alaska's North Slope. Yesterday, corrosion in just 16 of them shut down the largest oil field in the United States indefinitely. It knocked out 8% of the country's crude oil production, sent gas and oil prices spiking again, and threw a harsh light on the new vulnerability of energy flows worldwide. Rotting pipelines in Alaska are just the start. In Nigeria, unrest has knocked production back. Angry nations from Venezuela to Iran have threatened cutoffs. Analysts fear civil war in Iraq could mean regional war in the heart of global oil country. And then there's hurricane season. Up next on Point, dwindling supplies, rotting pipes, threat of war, and the world's unsettling new energy vulnerability. We're going to hear voices from right around the world today, but we start in Anchorage, Alaska, with Wesley Loy. He is the oil and gas reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Wesley Loy, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. I'm happy to be with you.
What's the latest on the timetable here? How long is the biggest oil field in the country going to be out of commission?
Well, executives for the oil company that run the field, BP, say that they're going to replace about 16 miles of very important pipelines within the Prudhoe Bay field. And to do that is likely to take weeks or months to accomplish, and so some or all of the production of Prudhoe Bay could be out for a really protracted period of time.
Describe for us, if you would, Wesley, this pipeline, where it sits in the whole network of pipelines up there. This isn't the main pipeline that we all know running north to south in Alaska. It's somewhere in the feeder system?
That's right. There is a cluster of pipelines across basically the top of Alaska, and these pipelines, it's a network, sort of a spider web of pipelines. These drain various oil fields in the extreme north of Alaska, and those pipes basically take oil from the wells and carry it to progressively larger pipes, and those pipes feed into the big Trans-Alaska oil pipeline that goes 800 miles to the south to a tanker port at Valdez. And from there, the oil is carried to market aboard ships.
So down to the California refineries that deal with this, 400,000 barrels of oil out of commission, enough, we read here, to fill 280,000 Ford Expeditions, 8% of U.S. daily oil production. Wesley, let me ask you, we've all seen oil company profits just over the moon lately. I'm sure BP participated in that. How could it be, with plenty of money running around, that the pipeline system would have been allowed to deteriorate to this point?
Well, the company, BP, points out that the problems that we're experiencing right now, the pipes that have sprang leaks, were pipes that weren't expected to have corrosion problems. These pipes carry oil that's been basically processed and made ready for the market. And the water that normally comes up out of the ground mixed with the oil, and it's that water that really tends to trigger corrosion, that water has been stripped out of the oil by the time it reaches the pipes at issue here.
So they were surprised by this. But how could that be? I mean, here's 8% of our national production at a time when we all know what oil prices are. They've got plenty of money and manpower to look at these pipes. How could they not? And they've had leaks recently. They had a huge spill on the Tundra just a few months ago. I mean, don't they have regular inspection of these pipelines?
In fact, they do. And the company spends many millions of dollars every year to try to suppress corrosion. Corrosion's a constant problem. It's a constant enemy in the oil patch. And so the company spends a lot of money on, for instance, chemical inhibitors that are these chemicals are put into the pipeline to try to suppress the spread of corrosion.
But it didn't work here. The oil field there, 30 years old now, and we read with the network of pipelines that was designed to last 25 years. What's the reaction been in Alaska, Wesley? You all live with this industry right in your backyard. Are people shocked, or are people saying it was only a matter of time?
Well, you know, I think that people are kind of alarmed by it, and the oil field is really important to the economy of the state. It's a tremendous revenue producer for the state government, and I think people were sort of surprised to see the field brought down. But I think there's also a lot of confidence that this is really temporary, and the problem will be resolved, and the oil will start flowing again.
You're well past the peak of summer on the North Slope. It will get cold in a hurry there. Does it matter to the main big pipeline coming down across Alaska if it's not full of oil, if it's not running at capacity? Are there structural implications there?
There's some technical issues. For instance, one of the big concerns is that the pipeline, the Trans-Alaska pipeline, really is designed to carry much larger volumes of oil than will be flowing down the pipeline in the coming weeks. And so that could create some technical issues, particularly we're told as the weather gets colder and the volumes of oil going down that pipeline are smaller, it will actually take a lot more days for the oil to reach the tanker port at Valdez. And so while the oil is in the pipeline coming down, the oil, which is normally hot, will cool down such that it could actually sort of gum up and create some problems.
Pretty incredible that it would happen now when we've got so many threats to oil around the world, that this would happen, that it would not be foreseen. I mean, we've got Representative John Dingell, a Michigan congressman, saying it's appalling that BP let this critical pipeline deteriorate to the point that a major production shutdown was necessary. It does look kind of appalling.
Well, one has to remember that the network of pipelines that have to be looked after on the slope, on the North Slope of Alaska, are really vast. And it's probably pretty hard to expect just perfection and to never have a leak or never have a corrosion problem.
Perfection, but now we've got the biggest oil field in the country shut down, and we understand that it's complicated, and we appreciate your filling us in on some of the reasons why. Wesley Loy at the Anchorage Daily News, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I want to turn now to Houston, Texas, and Amy Jaffe. She's a fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University, an expert in the energy business. Amy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, you're an expert in the business. Look around the planet with us. We're getting a little nervous here. I mean, we just lost the biggest oil field in the country, and you look at the hot spots. People are pointing to them all over, from Venezuela to Nigeria to, I mean, just look at the Middle East and the Iran and the potential civil war in Iraq spilling over into Saudi Arabia. Is this not a new level of risk as you look out on the world?
Well, I would say that we're in a bad position. Not only all the different conflicts that you mentioned that could disrupt oil, but then seasonally we start to get to the winter, so high seas in the Black Sea could mean we can't get Russian oil out from Siberia. So we're facing a lot of challenges. In the past, the market's been very resilient because, as you said in your opener, there were countries like Saudi Arabia and others that could increase their production if something went wrong. And so we, the consumer here in America, didn't feel that pinch. But we've had so many different things happen, and demand has grown so astronomically worldwide that the market really doesn't have resilience today. And that is why the announcement that BP is going to have to take its field down for weeks/months move the market $2 higher.
Let's look at a couple aspects of this. First, simple supply. Is there any risk of actual shortages developing? And secondly, price. It went almost to $77 a barrel yesterday. Look at supply and price for us, Amy.
Well, I think people have to think about price today the way you would think about buying something on eBay or being at an auction. There'll be some buyers for whom this fuel is very, very valuable. Someone who lives in a city without public transportation, for example, here in the United States, and we will outbid someone, say, in India or some poorer country that really can't afford to pay for this high a price of oil.
But so, that bids it up high for everyone, including Americans. What's the industry saying? How high could prices go?
Well, I mean, I myself, back last spring, was saying that if we had some things go wrong, we were really going to be able to see by September $80 oil. I'm looking very correct. Now I'm thinking if something additional goes wrong. Now, we already have disruptions in Nigeria because of rebel fighting there. But if something major were to go wrong, the conflict in the Middle East were to spread, or we had a successful terrorist attack on a major oil installation, say, in the Middle East, or something of that ilk, I think, you know, that $100 world that everybody predicted in the 1970s and never happened, I think we could see that in our lifetime, given the kind of circumstances we're seeing in the market today.
Have you ever seen this level of vulnerability in the world's energy system, Amy, you know, in your years in the business?
This is the worst I've ever seen it. It's kind of hard to believe that we did a task force in 2000, and we warned that this could come down the pike, and we tried to get sort of political consensus on what needed to be done as Americans, and it's just amazing to me that we're now 6 years later.
Right now we're joined from Nicosia, Cyprus, by Gerald Butt. He is editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey, a top weekly journal covering the oil and gas industry. Gerald Butt, thanks for being with us.
Hello there, Tom.
Can you feel the ripples from far-off cold Alaska in the hot Middle East these days?
Well, it's sounding a very familiar story, isn't it? Disruption to supplies.
Yes.
It's the topic of the moment, I can tell you, in this corner of the globe. I'm sitting in Cyprus, which is actually at the very extreme eastern end of Europe, but geographically it sits on the rim of the Middle East, and so we're looking down at all the chaos there. And frankly, as Amy has said, I've never really in the years, 20 or 30 years of covering the Middle East, seen so many problems at one time.
Roll the map out a little wider for us here. We've started in Alaska, but take us through the Middle East and describe for us how oil people, oil experts, are looking at, I mean, we've got fighting all over the place and the potential for a whole lot more. What does that mean for how oil experts are looking at supplies and flows in the years ahead, the risk factors?
Well, the one big risk, of course, is that Iran or one of the Arab Gulf states should somehow become embroiled in the current fighting that's going on in Lebanon, if that were to spread, say, to encompass Syria and draw Iran in as well. That would bring a footprint of violence right across the main oil-producing region of the Middle East. That would be extremely serious news. That's the worst scenario that the experts are looking at. Basically, around two-thirds of OPEC's crude oil production passes through the very narrow straits of Hormuz at the southern end of the Gulf. Mm. Any kind of outbreak of fighting in Iran, there would, of course, be the threat that tankers would not be able to get through that strait, either because of fighting or because insurance rates were too high.
So there's potential spillover from the fighting now in Lebanon, Israel, and Hezbollah if it goes further, if it should touch Iran. What about spillover from the conflict in Iraq? There's now talk of civil war, even by top American generals. How is the oil industry factoring that into its crystal ball looking forward?
Well, there are two aspects to that, really. One is the big hope at the time of the invasion of Iraq and the immediate aftermath that one might see a boom in oil production in Iraq. That hope has faded, and if there was to be civil war, the hope would be kicked into the far future. The other possibility, of course, is, as you say, that if there is civil war, then it could ignite social unrest among the Shia population in eastern Saudi Arabia, and that's the very heart of the oil-producing region of that vast mega producer. That is a possibility, and there is a possibility of social unrest further afield, but in the areas that are politically sensitive and that are extremely important when it comes to looking at the supply of oil to the global market.
And Gerald, let me ask you about that supply out of the Middle East. Historically, at a crunch moment like this, Saudi Arabia would open the spigots, let more oil flow, take advantage of those high prices, and stabilize them somewhat. But this time, they've actually cut back on the oil coming out of Saudi wells. Why?
Well, the problem here comes down to the quality of the oil, Tom. We tend to think of oil as being just one substance, like perhaps Coca-Cola, but the same all the way around the world. But the kind of oil that is produced, a lot of the oil that's produced in Saudi Arabia, is of heavier, sour grades that don't meet the needs of refineries in the West, where there are increasing demands to have low sulfur fuels and so on.
Now, didn't they used to have the sweetest, finest oil on the planet? Is this because they're sort of getting down to the dregs of what's left? Why?
No, it's not. It's just that they are, in terms of those fields that they are expanding, they happen to produce this rather heavier crude. It has its uses, and there are sales in the Far East, for example. But right now, the Saudis are saying that they are producing more than they are able to sell, simply because their spare isn't the kind of oil that we in the West are looking for.
But the quality, not so great. I mean, at this rate, who knows? Pretty soon we'll be happy to burn cow chips. I don't know. Let our listeners in here for a minute. Kathleen's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi there. Forgive my laryngitis.
Okay.
But I'm very upset because there was money. We now heard that the oil and gas industry have enjoyed the highest profits. I understand about risk. I understand about all of these things that they claim that they have to do and the spot markets and all of that.
Right.
But BP was obligated to have a portion of that money, whether it's a return on investment, whatever it is, to go in there and check those pipes other than once every 7 years. They had an obligation. Now, what I want to know, and ask anyone you please in the industry,
all right,
is whether or not they are going to be held accountable in the sense that the prices they're going to share in this giving back to the public for their inability to maintain the pipes.
Yeah, it's kind of an irony. The pipes go bad, but the prices go up. So, in effect, they'll benefit, even though they're scrambling with a real problem here. Kathleen, let us pick that up. And Amy Jaffe, let me come to you. You're right there in oil country. Kathleen says, how could this happen? I mean, what's the word down there? This doesn't look competent for such a big oil field to just go offline because of corrosion. Shouldn't that be tracked? Don't they have enough money with all those billions in profit to stay on top of something like this?
Well, you know, when we hear of a story like that in an African country or someplace else, we arrogantly say, well, if they'd let our companies in, this wouldn't have happened because we're so technically able. Ironically, if you look at the press coverage of the BP announcement, they said they used ultrasonic testing, which is sort of fancy testing that's supposed to detect corrosion, and they said that it failed. But it's been 14 years since they sent a mechanical cleaner down this pipeline, and that does not seem to me to ring as the industry standard. I do think that there probably will be investigations of their activities. If it is found that they are negligent, someone will collect a penalty, whether it will be the state of Alaska or people who will sue them civilly. I think there'll be big ramifications for BP. We've already seen some heads roll at BP because of the problems here at the Texas City refinery. And
the explosion there killed 15 workers in March last
year. Right. I would expect to see more executive changes at BP.
Well, let me ask you, and its partners in Alaska, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips. Let me ask you this, Amy. The Alaskan oil fields are not producing what they once did. Does that mean that BP and its partners don't have the same incentive to upgrade this infrastructure? Are they somehow, you know, if it's a dwindling supply, are they resistant to keeping it in ship shape?
Well, indeed, you know, as a strategy, one would want to minimize additional spending, but still, you know, especially ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, these are companies that really pride themselves on their safety practices, and Exxon, you know, since the Valdez incident, has sort of overemphasized the importance of top operations. So it is really pretty shocking when you learn that they had a technical presumption that corrosion could not happen to this line, and therefore they were very confident that they didn't have to use old-fashioned methods to check it, even after having a leak. Because remember, they had a leak in March, and we only now know that they need to turn off the line because the Department of Transportation made its own investigation.
And that was 200,000 gallons of crude leaking in March. Gerald Butt, from where you sit there on the rim of the Middle East looking back toward Alaska, what are you hearing from oil executives and workers out there? Does it look dismaying to them that this should happen with a top flight oil company in an American oil field, or just the risk of this kind of business?
No, very much a sense of dismay. As Amy was saying, international oil companies are trying very hard to get a foothold in countries like Saudi Arabia in the upstream, in the development of exploration and production of oil. And they're finding it extremely difficult because of the power of the national oil companies in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, and elsewhere. And so their argument that their technology is needed, their skills is needed, will be much harder to put across in the light of what's happened in Alaska.
Let me take a call from Waterbury, Connecticut. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you folks?
Very well. What do you think, Mike?
Well, you mentioned a couple minutes ago the term dwindling supply. And, I mean, it's pretty well known that over the next, 50 to 100 years, the output of world oil output is going to decrease. Well, meanwhile, the world demand for energy, mainly in the form of oil, is increasing faster than it's even decreasing.
Yeah, we all know it. So when you look at what happened in Alaska yesterday, what does it make you think?
Well, what happened in Alaska seems to just be an infrastructure problem. The industry knows that over time it will run out of oil. You think they would, as one other caller said, be a little more proactive in maintaining the supply chain.
You would, and if the walls are closing in here, Amy Jaffe, let me go to you first with the peak oil theory. There's a lot of debate around that. Saudi Arabia and other countries like to say they've got plenty still on the shelf underground. But could it be, the peak oil theorists have said if we're past our maximum, trouble will set in long before we run out of oil. It's just the greater scarcity won't keep it bulging through pipelines, and every little problem will be magnified. Do you see this as an instance of that?
Well, I think personally, we're all guessing because no one really 100% knows
right.
What's under the ground. I mean, I don't think we've hit the peak yet, because if we'd hit the peak, people would be selling oil fields for $80 a barrel, and we're not seeing people selling oil fields for $10 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't hit that point yet, and we don't 100% know when we hit that point. What I like to say, because I'm a technical optimist
Okay. Working
at a scientific institution, I like to say that I'm hoping that we will, way before we have to worry about peaking in oil production, whether that's 30 years from now or 50 years from now or 75 years from now, I would hope that we're going to come up with something cheaper, cleaner, and more sophisticated to use to move ourselves about and to power our homes. And, when you look at what the U.S. government is doing and compare it to what's happening in Japan and China and other places, I would like to see more response from our government and our industry in looking at what's the next stage.
Gerald Butt, we'd all like to see that, but here we are. If Amy's right, maybe 30 years away from peak oil. Who knows? Some say we've already passed it. But we've got a problem on our hands right now. I mean, is the sense in the Middle East that we're racing ahead of this problem, or that it's being turbocharged by politics catching up with us quicker, possibly, than a peak itself might suggest?
Well, there are those in the Middle East who feel quite confident that the latest figures are that something like 60% of proven oil reserves lie in that region, and therefore they feel that they can be pretty comfortable that there will be these minor hiccups from time to time, minor crises in the scheme of things, but ultimately the world will have to turn to the Middle East. But quite interestingly, the Saudi oil minister Ali Naimi said recently that the Arabs shouldn't be quite so complacent, because the West was pressing ahead with the kind of inventions that Amy was talking talking about. And the former Saudi minister Sheikh Yamani famously said a year or so ago that the Stone Age didn't end because the world ran out of stones. So there is a feeling, a growing feeling in the Middle East, that the complacency is wrong. They are in a driving seat at the moment, but that could end very quickly, either because of a major conflict that engulfed the region or because of technological scientific breakthrough in the United States or elsewhere.
It may come, but I mean, already in the real here and now, we see, I mean, here's Senator Richard Lugar, Indiana Republican, saying, "No one who is honestly assessing the decline of American leverage around the world due to our energy dependence can fail to see that energy is the albatross of U.S. national security." And that's already. Troy is calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Troy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. What I wanted to say is that I believe the rise of religious fundamentalism in Middle East and also here in the U.S., different lobbies, the Jewish lobbies, the far right Christian lobby, they are all fighting for pushing their own religion and religious ideas around the globe, and
What's it have to do with the flow of oil, Troy?
Well, when the U.S. government makes a decision about the Middle East, if it doesn't have the American people's interest in heart, and it's listening to a special group of people who want certain things to happen in the Middle East, then it affects. In effect, the flow of oil.
But it's in no one's interest, is it? I mean, whether you're in the Christian right, or you're in Israel, or you're in Lebanon, or you're in Andover, Massachusetts, it's not
that's
in
right.
your interest for the oil to stop flowing.
Sure, that's exactly why it doesn't make sense. Does the Secretary of Wireless in Iraq, does it make sense when people are just thinking about religion and not thinking about, what is the good thing to do for everybody else?
Let me turn to Amy Jeffy with that. Amy, Condoleezza Rice complaining recently that the pressure on oil and gas was distorting international politics in a very major way. Do you see the U.S. government as fully at grips? I mean, maybe they're playing on an old battlefield here where you can just mind the politics and not mind the oil. Do they have that flow, that supply, front and center in mind?
Well, I have to say I agree with Senator Lugar. I mean, we are at great risk that we will make a diplomatic mistake or some kind of a military mistake in the Middle East, and it's going to affect the mobility of all Americans. And I agree with Troy. I don't think people in this country understand what's at stake. Gerald outlined a very negative scenario, which seems remote but is not impossible, where we mismanage the civil war in Iraq, say we follow the Connecticut politics and we just withdraw from Iraq thinking that we just don't want to be involved, and that civil war spreads between Iran and Saudi Arabia, activating populations in both those countries, we're talking about the kinds of disruptions in oil supply we saw in 1979 with the kind of effects that we saw in 1979.
Right now, from Lexington, Massachusetts, we're joined by Nigel Gault. He's lead U.S. economist at Global Insight, Inc., international economic consulting firm. Nigel Gault, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So here we are. We're looking at $77 a barrel for oil yesterday. People talking about it potentially going higher. Iran at one point saying, mess with us and you'll see $200 a barrel oil. What about, just begin with the Alaska announcement yesterday, how do you see the impact of that little price hike rippling through the economy? Does it matter?
A couple of dollars here or there doesn't matter, but what this does, it just tightens the demand-supply balance a little bit more in the oil markets, makes us more vulnerable to any other supply cutoffs that might be on the way, and just increases the vulnerability of the U.S. and global economies to a potential spike in oil prices.
Now, Amy Jaffe saying she was foreseeing maybe $80 a barrel. We're close to that now. Others saying, this could easily spike on up toward 100. At what point, Nigel Gault, does it begin to have real implications that people feel that, I mean, we've heard about the U.S. economy flirting with recession right now. What's the number it has to hit before it's not just a couple dollars here or there? It's really a problem.
Yeah. I mean, if we had this conversation a few years ago, we would certainly have been imagining that we'd be in recession if oil had hit 70, 75, where we are now. So it's very hard to say exactly where the tipping point is that turns us down into recession. Clearly, we're at a point now where oil is starting to have a significant impact, slowing down growth in the U.S. and global economies. I think the important thing really is not how high prices get, but why they get there. Up to now, for the last few years, most of the increase in oil prices has been driven by demand. So demand has been increasing, but we satisfied that at a higher price. The big risk now, since things are so tight, is that we have a supply shut off in some part of the world. Then we would actually have to reduce the demand for oil around the world. That would require a substantially higher price and also lower activity around the globe. So if we're talking 100 to 125, which we might well be if there was a significant supply shut off, I think that would have major downside implications for global growth.
What do you mean by major downside implications? Is that a recession like we've come through before, or is it something worse?
I think we're talking, it's real recession risk, not necessarily something worse, but recession risk. You'll be hitting a U.S. economy which is already slowing down, so I think we're vulnerable here. The housing market is slowing down. Residential construction activity is declining. Consumer spending growth seems to be slowing. If you hit a slowing economy with a spike in oil prices on top of that, that would be a recipe to take us into recession.
Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. Jamal is on the line. Hi, Jamal. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I just want to be able to stress that listening to all these callers today, I mean, that no one has been stressing no one has been stressing an idea to try to be able to reduce demand overall by conservation and bringing in current technologies to try and be able to reduce our dependence upon oil.
Well, Amy Jaffe is saying we've got to do that and maybe faster than we ever thought, but you think it's not happening fast enough?
Oh, not at all. I mean, there are numerous things that we can do today to be able to reduce just a little bit of our consumption with oil, and we aren't really doing them because people are used to spending a whole lot. And
yeah, well, clearly we've had this heat wave and air conditioners cranked up to max. Nigel Gault, as an economist looking at this, we've heard from Amy and Gerald. As an economist, when do you expect alternative energy supplies to begin to become factors that would relieve some of this pressure from high oil prices?
I think we're talking a matter of years here. This is not something that turns around overnight. Remember that it was only 3 years ago or so we were looking at oil prices at around $25. Now, we've had a rapid run up to $75, of course, now, but it takes a long time for behavior to adjust on the demand side, for people to factor in higher oil prices on an extended basis for a prolonged period of time. Then they'll start making adjustments in their behavior. Then alternative fuels become much more viable. But the lead times here are long, and they're certainly too long for our immediate interest in global growth.
And what about the global economic picture? We heard earlier that, okay, as you say, that we've got something new here, not a demand shortage, but a supply shortage potentially. New bidders for that in China, in India. We heard, well, the U.S. will just bid it up and pay more because we're a rich country. But what if that begins to hit the economy of China or India? How does that ripple around the planet?
I mean, to some extent, these countries, particularly in Asia, try to dampen the impact of higher oil prices through subsidies to prevent them passing through to their consumers. Of course, they can't do that. They can't do that indefinitely because their government budget deficits would surge higher. But if those economies start to slow down as a result of the higher energy prices, that, of course, damages one of the key motors of the global economy. The past few years, the global economy has been driven by the U.S. and really by China and, to a lesser extent, India. So if the U.S. is slowing down and then China and India on top of that slow, you're taking away really both of the engines of the global economy.
Jerry's calling from Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
How are you, sir?
Very well. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, number one, I really resented the last comment that was made about a couple of dollars here and a couple of dollars there. It doesn't really matter. Maybe it doesn't matter if you're making $400,000 or $500,000 a year or $100,000 a year, but I'm having to put $15 a day in a gas tank to get to and from work, and that does matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
Experts who you know, their incomes obviously are much greater than mine, because maybe a couple of dollars here and a couple of dollars there doesn't really matter to them.
But you're feeling it at the gas tank, and that $15 a day comes right out of the household budget.
Yes. You know. And then the other thing is that I don't believe for one instance the BP had to shut down the oil field. I believe that they feel that there's going to be a change in the election in November, and they need to milk the economy for all it's worth before there's a Democratic in one of the houses of Congress to do some investigations and to see where all this problems is going from.
Wow, that's some deep skepticism. Let us pick it up. Amy Jaffe, I mean, people do look at the huge profits and wonder if there's room for manipulation of markets here. I'm not saying that BP, you know, wanted corrosion in its pipelines. As you say, it may have to pay a piper for that. On the other hand, all this trouble has pushed oil prices up very high. Do the oil companies have conflicted interests here? Are the heightened risk factors at some level working in their favor?
Well, I think we have to look at BP as a company. BP is a troubled company with a troubled management, and believe me, they would like to have avoided these mistakes that they have made. So there's no conspiracy here. We're not bringing down the Alaska portion of the pipeline. They are going to be sued. They wouldn't have brought the pipeline down but for the intervention of the federal government to investigate whether the pipeline was operating safely. As we heard from your guest from Alaska, people in Alaska are shocked and appalled that they have to experience this. So I don't see any conspiracy there. But there is a difference between the private sector and the public sector interests. And it might be in the favor of an OPEC country like Saudi Arabia or a large oil company today to not invest heavily in bringing on new oil supply, because they're going to get a higher price if we don't see a lot of supply coming on. So, but there's two ways of looking at that. The company that would go out and drill and drill and drill, like, say, take a Marathon or some of the companies that have had very good exploration success in recent years, those companies are going to do very, very well now, and their management is going to be highly rewarded. So it's a mixed bag, but it does bring in this issue that your caller raises, which is that for the average American, this is very painful. And therefore, we need our government, the federal government and the Congress, to think about the greater good. And we're not getting that on the Hill. We have technologies that exist today. We already know how to have a plug-in hybrid. They actually physically exist. They're going to be sold this year. We know how to do this. This isn't like we have to go for 20 years and investigate how to use biofuels or how to use battery cars. That technology is on the market. And on top of that, you know, I asked the caller, you know, how have people adjusted their driving habits?
Yep.
How have people adjusted what they're doing in their homes? Has everybody insulated their home, right? There are many small things, from filling your tires to just making sure that you have proper insulation in your attic, that people can do to reduce their energy consumption, and there are things that you should do anyway. But
those always seemed like somewhere down the road, and now it looks like this whole thing could grab us by the throat sooner than we thought.
Well, and indeed, people, you know, need to wrap their mind around. I mean, we saw that in Rita and Katrina. We did not have fuel here in Houston to evacuate. A lot of people in this city, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people in this city, made the decision to sit in a windowless room in their home rather than try to evacuate to some place that could be safer, because they knew they wouldn't be able to get the fuel to evacuate. I came on your radio show and talked about this problem. I did evacuate, and I was on the show from Denver.
Yes.
And I had a talk show host from Boston say that people from Boston didn't want to give up their drive to Maine to see the foliage, because that would hurt the local economy. We have to think like a nation.
Decisions to be made here. David's calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, David?
What I'm wondering, Tom, is I wonder when this growing crisis is going to educate the country at large, broadly, about the kind of political leadership we need in this country. Jimmy Carter who tried to start curing this problem 30 years ago, is popularly ridiculed as a foreign policy wimp. This cowboy in chief we have now, this alleged tough guy, is destroying this country with his lack of foresight and intelligent planning for, you know, the future we're actually going to face.
So irony, the oil man you think may sort of outright his industry or the oil flow. Let me put that to our observer on the cusp of the Middle East, Gerald. But from your perch there, editor in chief, Middle East Economic Survey, how do you think the United States foreign policy is doing keeping that region stable and keeping energy supplies flowing?
Well, I'll be polite and say I don't think it's doing very well. I think the problems that have been faced in Iraq really weren't thought through at all. There was no post-war planning. I think the support that the United States is giving for the Israeli assault on Lebanon is losing it a lot of friends. And more importantly than that, it's making America's allies in the Arab world, the governments on whom the West depends for getting the oil supplies out safely to the world markets. It's making them extremely uncomfortable, because what they're seeing, partly in reaction to American policies, is a rise in populist parties, populist organizations like Hezbollah in Lebanon, like Hamas in the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Muslim Brotherhood did extremely well in elections recently in Egypt. Mm. You're seeing more and more success for the Islamic populist groups at the expense of the governments that we, the West, rely on in order to keep security in the countries where there is oil and to keep the oil lanes, the oil pipelines open.
Is there a sense, if we have American generals now again talking about the possibility of civil war in Iraq, if that should happen, is there an understanding that the American military or international forces could secure enough of the core Mideast oil supply that the world wouldn't go dark or not?
No, I don't think there is. I don't think there's been any kind of planning along those lines. It was quite interesting at a meeting of Gulf leaders a few months ago, the Kuwaiti emir or his deputy who was at the meeting called on other GCC states to start looking at alternative ways of getting the oil out of the region in case the Straits of Hormuz were to be blocked. Here for the first time, just a few months ago, they were thinking of ways around that difficulty. There's been no planning either in the region or outside for the kind of scenario that we just might be seeing around the corner.
Amy Jaffe, you said earlier we've got to get I'm not sure what your phrase was, but some grown-ups in here to really think this through. Who would that be traditionally? I mean, does that mean the voters are responsible to get that going, or who pulls all these threads together? Are you confident that it's happening? You've got oil men in the White House and around the White House now. They must be acutely aware of what's going on here. Who pulls a policy together to push this forward? Does it depend on the man and woman in the polls?
Well, I think you have to have a combination. The man and woman in the polls has to assert themselves on this issue. And, you know, in fairness to the White House has talked about very interesting programs. The president himself, after the State of the Union, went out to our National Renewable Lab and reinstated funding for solar energy. He went to visit Johnson Tools.
Yep.
And congratulated them on these interesting lithium batteries that could go in our cars. He's got it. The question is, how do we push that through the Hill? We as voters have tolerated letting the car companies and the coal companies and all these interests block legislation that would be good. We can't. The president's hands are tied. He cannot fund a program to have a major support for new energy technologies if he can't get the allocation through the Hill. So we really need, as voters, to stand up and be counted. We are letting the industries that will be hurt by a shift to new technologies, we are letting them dominate the discussion and confuse us when, you know, from your caller ends, it's pretty clear people are not confused. We need to assert ourselves.
Nigel Galt, we've just got half a minute here. What do you think is going to speak first as an economist? Will it be the economy getting our attention or political change?
I think it's the economy. We need to the political change, I think, takes too long to put into effect, both to take action and then for those actions to start to feed their way through into the system. And the risks in the immediate future to the economy are too great for political action to make much difference in the near term.
But the economy itself may speak if these prices get any higher, maybe already. Nigel Gault at Global Insight, Inc., thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Gerald Butt, Editor-in-Chief of the Middle East Economic Survey in Nicosia, Cyprus. Mr. Butt, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Amy Jaffe, back home in Houston at the Baker Institute, Rice University. Thank you, Amy, for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.